I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. My guest today is Andrew Weave Orenheimer, or Weave, as most people know him. He is a famous hacker and internet troll, as well as a white nationalist. I heard him interviewed at the Daily Show with my friends there, and also he's constantly showing up in my Facebook feed, up to all kinds of good stuff. So I just wanted to get acquainted. So Weave, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
So I know there are a lot of people out there who don't know that much about you because, honestly, although your name has been on the radar for me for the past couple of years, it was only really when I listened to the Daily Show that I actually got a sense of all the stuff you've been up to. So can you give us a little bit of background on yourself, where you're from, your education and stuff like that, and then maybe just give us a little sketch of your early claims to fame before you became an avowed white nationalist?
Well, I've been an avowed white nationalist from far before that I was famous, I think.
Okay.
I'm from the Ozarks, and that's where the feds kidnapped me from. I sort of had like a real terrible shit-lib family, you know, and I was confronted with racial questions from a very young age that sort of flipped me, you know.
Mm-hmm. About how old were you when you started thinking of yourself as a racialist?
I can't even remember. I guess around 14, 13, somewhere around there. Okay. My family was just utter, like my, just total cucks, right? Like my mom was like some, you know, protege of Diane Blair and political, wanted to be a political scientist. And she adopted a couple black kids to impress her liberal friends. And it was just absolute ground zero of cultural Marxism in my house. Right. And it was very hard not to notice that white people were different as a kid. Right.
You actually grew up with black adopted kids as your brothers or sisters?
Yeah. Two of them, one brother, one sister. And it's stark how different, you know, that they were. And it's, you know, I was always into opera and math and, you know, interesting things. And they were like foreigners in my house. Right.
Right.
And as time goes on, I get slowly a little bit more radicalized. I start at sort of school, you know, and there's so much like just being bombarded with me about how white people are bad all the time, you know, like how we are responsible for pretty much every single problem in the world. Right. And then the history that I read on my own time of, you know, sort of contradicted the narrative pretty terribly. It's, you know, we're taught that we're the sole responsible party for slavery and education systems. And, you know, it's not hard to notice that the very words slave comes from the Slavic race and, the Barbary slavery and how there are no white descendants of the slaves in North Africa. There's just this endless line over and over again that we've done all these terrible things when in fact that we're the least culpable for these particular crimes and we've done pretty much everything good in the world. So there's that.
It does balance things out a bit.
You know, like 300,000 black slaves came to America and we gave them health care and let them marry and there are a plentiful amount of their descendants and in contrast of the tens of millions of whites that were stolen to Africa, there are no descendants. I wonder what happened to them, right?
Oh yeah, that's something that never occurred to me, but yeah, what happened to all these people?
So. Yeah. I've been in Barbary territory pretty recently. I was in Morocco last year. No white people. That's for sure. Yeah. Like I was the only white person I saw in that particular time of year. So it's not hard to come to conclusions that something's quite wrong. Right. And then I go into higher education. Right. And there's the same, you know, there's the Jew Marx and he says that, you know, Western civilization is sick, that we need to be a religionless, cultureless worker class with no individualism allowed. And there's the Jew Freud, and he says that Western civilization is sick and that we need to, we obsess over our anuses and want to have sex with our mothers, right? And then, all of sort of the social sciences are based on the Jew Franz Boas, who says that, Western civilization is sick, that it's no better than the naked tribesmen of Africa who shit 5 feet from where they eat, right? So it's slowly, and then this is before I joined the financial industry, right? Like, I go get a job at a financial services company after all this, and then I interact with Jews on a regular basis, and this is what really sort of propelled me into full on, you know, it was the final red pill, I think.
So let me get this straight. You had experiences with non-whites in your own household starting at a very early age, and then you had an education, an American education, a standard American education, exposing you to all kinds of diversity. Then you go off and you work in the financial services industry and you get exposed to lots of Jews. How is it then that you came to dislike these people?
I don't know.
Yeah, I thought that racists were, you know, they were racist because they're ignorant, and obviously you seem to be challenging that thesis.
Yeah, I'm an internationally syndicated author and an engineer, and I've had all sorts of experiences and lived across several continents, and I still, you know, maybe my experience is atypical, but the more I get exposed to non-white civilization, the more that I'm really, really enthusiastic about white civilization.
Well, there's a reason why our number one and number two cities are generally, well, the number one city for Countercurrents readers is always New York, and number two fluctuates between generally London and Paris. Paris recently crept up there. And if you've been in any of those cities, you are maximally exposed to diversity. You know, I had this epiphany about 2003, I think it was. I was in New York and I was on a subway train, and there was this Negro. He must have been like 14 years old, and he was in the whole ghetto clown costume, you know, with the backwards cap and the baggy pants and everything and an oversized jersey. And he was screaming into this phone, "White bitch this and white bitch that," you know. And I looked across the car at these two pretty brunette girls. They looked like stereotypically Italian-American New York girls. And we made eye contact, and it was like they understood. We understood each other. We understood exactly what we were seeing. And then it occurred to me that New York must have more red-pilled people on race and Jews per capita than any other place in the United States, simply because of constant exposure to these people. Because really, it's experience that is the basis for racial hatred and discontent and tension. And that's why we believe in separation. We don't want to have these constantly triggering experiences, and we don't want to have what happens down the road oftentimes, which is anger and tension boils over into violence, ethnic cleansing. We don't want that. And our enemies are evil because they're making that kind of dystopia inevitable.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty much at this point, it's inarguable that the plan is to wipe out whites, right? Like, that's just, it's openly stated by world leaders. Sarkozy, of course, used the phrase, métissage obligatory, the mandatory miscegenation, right? Like, that's,
Well, there's this whole concept that's discussed, well, in the social sciences, economics, demographics, of the third demographic transformation. And when you really look at what the third demographic transformation is, it just means white genocide.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, no doubt.
You know, we're just going to be replaced by non-whites, and that's the end of us. Yeah, I have defended the thesis that white genocide is a real thing. I think that it's a very plausible thesis. I think the burden of proof is actually on the skeptics, because when you look at the situation and you find that every single white country has all the same problems, namely, we have collapsing families, we have rampant individualism, we have divorce, and we have below replacement birth rates, and also open borders, miscegenation, all of these things have been adopted. They have been created by human decisions. And the idea that the leaders and rulers, the ruling castes in all of these white societies are adopting all of these terrible policies, all within a space of a few decades of one another, and they know not what they do? It's not plausible.
It's not. And it's not plausible because they literally stand up on video like Sarkozy did and said, if people won't race mix, then coercion will be used. If somebody writes down a plan, publishes it and follows the plan, I believe they're following the plan, right?
Exactly. It's not just some strange coincidence. It's not some cosmic mistake. It's the product of human design and evil human design. There's nothing more evil than genocide, as our friends in the media constantly tell us. And, we're the targets. We're seeing we're in the headlights, and honestly, the idea that it's alarmist to think that whites can go extinct and that it's conspiratorial and paranoid to think that that is the plan. It's absurd. I mean, these are, I think, in large part just defense mechanisms that people have from the awful truth. 99.9% of species that have existed on this planet have gone extinct. So we have a very good chance of going extinct simply based on the fact that we exist. And then to see that all of the classic biological causes of extinction are applying to us. And beyond that, that they're man-made. We're not being obliterated by some errant comet hitting the planet. We're being obliterated by our own governments.
Yeah.
So what do we do to stop it? Well, let's go back to your story, I guess, first. So you through education and experience and hard knocks, you came to the worldview that you have. What are your views on religion? Did that provide you with like a impediment or encouragement? Were you religious or non-religious in your upbringing?
My household was very secular, and I never really saw religion as something other than like it's a potential tool, right? Like we have to live in the world that we live in, right? And we have to acknowledge that there are religious forces in it, and we have to use those forces to shape things in our favor. And, for a long time, I was trying to do the sort of positive Christianity thing, where maybe that we could shape Christendom into something that leads to salvation. But I just at this point, I feel like I follow Votan just sort of as a protest vote to be like, this is all fucking cuck shit, right? Like, yeah. I don't see any Christian institution that's actually doing anything that wins the A-B test if the metric is save whiteness. There's just none of them.
Well, I agree. I love the idea of Votan as your write-in candidate for deity. That's the protest vote.
Yeah. But it's the ancient poems of our forefathers. They have something to them, I think, that, part of how I came to where I'm at now insofar as faith is I went to prison for a little while and it was just, it was not deniable anymore watching all like the pedophiles, and all the brown hordes and all the Semitic altars, right? Like all getting their absolution from their priest or their imam or whatever. And I'm like, I want to be a member of the club that doesn't admit these people.
Right.
So there's that. And then, I was wrongfully imprisoned.
Right.
On some federal charges that, eventually I was freed thanks to an appeal decision, but it stole years of my life, three and a half years of my life. And there's a poem, the Volundarque Vitha, And in the Volundarque Vitha, the protagonist, Volund, he's sort of like the hacker of the ancient world, in that he comes up with magical machines, basically. And, And they do interesting things. And he's not just in the Norse poems. He's in the Saxon ones. He's, Wayland to the Saxons. He made a mail shirt that Beowulf wore.
Okay.
But Völund in this particular poem, he's kidnapped by a king and a queen of Sweden. And, they hobble him. They cut his hamstrings and they place him on an island. And instead of, you know, turning the other cheek and doing the good Christian thing, right? Well, Völund isn't down for that. He decides to kill their sons and make chalices out of their skulls, and then lure in their daughter and get her wasted. She's getting drunk off of her own brother's skull. She's drinking out of. It's pretty great scene, right? And then he rapes her and then after he rapes her, she falls in love with him, right? And he convinces her to go and steal a magic ring of his that lets him fly. And then he just sort of hovers over the castle for a minute and then waits for the king and the queen to get back, and just to let him know that, you know, he killed their sons and raped their daughter. And I'm like, this is the proper response to unjust imprisonment, right? This is great. You know, so it was my epiphany on the right thing to do.
So definitely polar opposites from turning the other cheek.
I don't think that, at least for the time being, you know, maybe the Orthodox might step up, right, and declare a crusade, and I'll bite my tongue and go to mass and then go help invade Anatolia, right? Like, that would be great. But in absence of like something really, really dramatic happening, I see no reason to throw my lot in with any Christian organization.
Before we started recording, you did say that you were somewhat attracted, at least momentarily, to Christian identity.
Yeah, I mean, it's just so convoluted to try to, as I read the Old Testament, right? Like, the people that are in the Old Testament are just despicable, right? Like, do I really want?
Yeah, who would want to claim that they're really us?
Yeah, do I really want to say that whites are Israelites after, like, they took over Canaan by tricking everybody into getting circumcised on a promise of marriage and then going and killing them all when their dicks were cut and they were, like, wounded from their dick cutting? Like, this is just really skeezy fucking shyster behavior, right? Like,
I was thinking of that very example. I was going to throw that very example out there because that's like one of the most unholy things in all of Holy Scripture.
Yeah.
Isn't circumcision a covenant with God? Yeah, yeah, but, you know, there's an angle that they can exploit from that. So, yeah, they're lovely people. They really are lovely people. So one of the things that I read in your Wikipedia thing is that, according to Wikipedia, you told Gawker that you had Jewish ancestry. So does the name Orenheimer echo, or is there something else going on here?
No, I was talking about how whites were the true Israelites, right? Because I was sort of like still doing the Christian identity thing and try to push Christendom towards something decent. But of course, then they printed that I'm a Hebe. But Auernheimer comes from Auernheim, Bavaria. There's not a lot of Jews there, and never been a Jewish place really. So, but no, the name Auernheimer does not echo.
So you're 100% pure Bavarian phenotype. Is that what I'm hearing here?
Oh no, I'm not 100% pure Bavarian. My grandmother's Scandinavian, my maternal grandmother, and my maternal grandfather is mostly Scot, and then my dad's side is Vendish.
Oh, okay. I wanted to get that out of the way because that sort of jumped off the page at me. And isn't it amazing the alchemy of journalism, how they can turn, you know, the CI thing into Weave admits that he's a Jew.
I definitely passed the Nuremberg laws. All my grandparents are Baptists and Methodists, respectively.
Okay. Well, that's good to know. So we can continue this conversation then. So after you got out of prison, you got thrown in jail basically on trumped up stuff connected with your hacking activities. It was vacated, you were released. Then you left the country, and it was at that time, I understand, that you made public your racialist views. Is that narrative correct? I mean, I'm just going on Wikipedia.
No, no. I mean, like, if you go back, like, hey, search my Twitter for Jew. Like, I was naming the Jew for all the time up until the point that okay. I got sentenced and thrown in prison. I mean, there was no, I mean, the point that I made public, I think, was 2008, which was years before I was ever indicted.
Okay. You see, thanks. I'm getting that narrative straight.
I think there was a large press effort to sort of, make my case not about me, but about the issues, you know, so they wanted to sort of, dampen everything that I was saying, even though I was pretty much shouting it still, right? Like I was not being politically correct, but there was so much more of a voice from the media. And I mean, I get it because my case was just not about me. It was about like, you know, everybody that does business on the internet. So they sort of wanted to put me on the back burner, I think. Mm-hmm. But,
okay. So, after you left the U.S., what have you been doing and where have you been traveling?
I started in Lebanon and, I mean, it was the only, non-extradition country that I sort of had connections at the time in. And then like, I noticed the government services failing, you know, and, there's that Beirut. I got out like a month before the Beirut trash crisis, you know, like I was like, I need to get the hell out of here. So then I went to Serbia and surfed the Balkans for a little while, like went to Croatia and Bosnia and whatnot. And then now I'm mostly in Abkhazia. Sometimes I'm in Moldova. I'm probably going to go to Kazakhstan, you know, just sort of surf in the former USSR, I suppose, is my, if it's got Cyrillic, then I'm probably willing to go there.
Abkhazia, it sounds like something from H.P. Lovecraft.
Yeah, it's actually a pretty new nation. It's not recognized by the United States, which makes it nice because the first barrier to legal assistance in that sort of territory is the United States has to go against their geopolitical interests and recognize that the nation exists. You know, right. So it's a very high barrier. I got it told, from like an international lawyer, you know, I'm like, I sort of just want to be out of the United States' reach for a really long time. And where should I go? And he was like, you need to go to Abkhazia. It is a, former Soviet, you know, breakaway republic. It used to be Georgia, but in the time of the troubles, you know, in the 90s, the Abkhaz, they took the chance to ethnically cleanse the Georgians and form their own nation. And it's really nice. Russians go there to party a lot. It's sort of like a vacation spot, you know.
It's got a really nice, mild coastal climate. It's sort of like Sochi, and it's similar climate-wise, right?
Yeah. I mean, you could march to Abkhazia from Sochi if you were really committed and had, you know, many days and a bottle of amphetamines. I'm sure you could get it done pretty easy. That's the first border you cross from if you go south from Sochi.
Yeah.
But the entire nation's GDP is basically internet crime, so it's a good place for somebody that is worried about various computer related things.
So they have good internet, in other words.
Yeah, they have great internet. You know?
Yeah. Well, Bernie Sanders is going to promise us all internet as good as Eastern Europe. So.
Yeah. I'm sure you'll get it. You know, government run bandwidth broadband programs have just gone over so well in America. They've all been a clusterfuck. all the community broadband is just none of it worked. So
what's the cost of living in Abkhazia?
It's very low. I'd say it's if you want to live in like the main city, which is Suhumi, you know, you could get by on $300 a month or less, you know, I'm a little bit taxed because I'm an American, you know, and I probably can't haggle because I don't speak Russian or Abkhaz, you know, so I'm sure I'm paying a little more, but it's very cheap, you know.
Yeah. So Abkhaz, is that an Indo-European language? Is it related to Georgian? What sort of language is it?
You know, it's sort of like Finnish in that it's not really related to anything around it. And the interesting thing about the Abhas is that they have a completely unbroken pagan tradition that has existed forever. Like they never really, you know, they did sort of a taqiyya where they're like, oh yeah, we're Christian, or oh yeah, we're Muslim, you know, but most of the people that say that they're Muslim here have no idea what the Quran is. You know, when I said like Jazakallahu khairan, they were like, what? You know, like they clearly never actually engaged, you know, and then you find out that everybody actually practices the ancient ancestral religions here. And, it's really cool that they've never really been broken away from their ancestral traditions.
That is really interesting. Actually, that's kind of remarkable. So what do the people look like? Are they sort of like the Georgians and other people of that area, basically?
Yeah. They look sort of, you know, they're a little bit Cossackized, but they definitely still look like Caucasoid people.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So one of the big things that you recently had your name attached to was this hijacking printers thing and printing out flyers for the Daily Stormer. Can you even talk about that? Or I just thought that was a scream. Okay.
So. Yeah, absolutely. I Daily Stormer sort of got an IRC channel and suddenly it's filled with, you know, a bunch of bright kids, right? And I just, like once per year that I'll do something and it strikes like a lightning bolt to, you know, usually, and this one definitely hit hard, is I just scanned the internet for open printers, and it's, like people just put their printer on the open internet, right? And, and break into anything, you know, I don't think I violated the law. They're trying to do legal gymnastics right now to figure out something to charge me with, which is
you stole paper.
Yeah.
Unauthorized copying.
I don't think there was a legal scholar arguing in Forbes that I violated the Junk Fax Protection Act because printers meet the definition of law of facsimile machines, but the Junk Fax Protection Act explicitly defines unsolicited advertisements and that it has to be a commercially available product or service. And if my flyers advertise global white supremacy, and if that's commercially available, then I'll buy 10 right now. I scanned the internet for open printers. I found tens of thousands. Well, not the whole internet. I scanned the sort of the Aaron IPs, which is the North American internet. And, I found tens of thousands of them. And then I printed to them all a very nice flyer, you know, said, white man, are you tired of the Jews? You know, ruining your country through mass immigration and degeneracy, and some large swastikas, and come join the struggle for global white supremacy at the Daily Stormer. Mm-hmm. And it just sort of, suddenly there's all these university leaders issuing, you know, just terrible condemnations of these acts of horrid hate speech, you know, and there were literally like thousands of police reports filed, and like just the pure fucking shitlib reaction was great. You know, it was like endless tears, you know,
endless butthurt, endless giggling, endless tweets, no doubt.
Yeah. And just, you know, I sort of collected the reactions, some of the better ones in Astorify and the aggregated all the press stuff. And it was just, and then it broke national. The Washington Times broke the story, and then it just was everywhere. It was in everything. It was pretty good. You know, it's I generally try to do these things where I act at like huge scale. You know, with very little effort, because A, I'm lazy, and I don't want to spend tens of hours, right? So the majority of things that I do now are either hugely scaled, or I'm making frameworks that train other people how to do the things that I do. I have sort of a conversational conversion framework. I call it the race methodology, reconnect, antagonize, condescend, exhibit. And, And it teaches people how in the span of a single conversation, if somebody will have a conversation with you, you have a very good conversion rate to converting them into a white nationalist ideology on the spot. You know, and I'm not the only one that uses this. Like Ricky Vaughn uses this. Like a bunch of people have had really great successes using this method to just sit down next to someone or start, you know, a private conversation on Twitter with somebody. And at the end of it, they're down for the cause.
Well, that sounds exciting. So why don't you lay that out? It's not a secret, I imagine.
No. I made a post on my posting career about it. You can Google "I sing a song of race war," but okay. Basically, it's about making a dialectic contrast between white civilization and non-white civilization. So the first thing I do is I inundate somebody with white culture. You know, I might link them to some arias performed by a countertenor that I appreciate, Andreas Scholl or Philippe Jaruski, or I might start quoting poetry to them, right? But that's the first step is reconnection, is that you must actively confront somebody with artifacts of European culture and assert strongly that they're European culture.
Mm-hmm.
So, The next two steps are often not necessary, but they're antagonize and condescend. And the antagonize step is about rebuttaling any like doubts they have with just like full on no apologies. Like, yes, we have to exterminate the blacks. Like no matter how much, like somebody asked me, would you even hang Obama? And I'm like, yes. and the condescend is if they start talking about like the liberal, you know, it's unsophisticated, right? Like you start acting like they don't know anything because they don't, right? Like,
right.
Like I start saying like, I have lived in Arab lands, right? You're talking about like, diversity and tolerance through Muslims. Muslims don't even appreciate their culture. Beirut has an ancient Roman hippodrome that they just fucking paved over to make apartments, right? Like,
yeah.
Like what these people at best have no stewardship of their cultural artifacts. And at worst, they're actively attempting to destroy them in Iraq and Syria. They don't respect their culture and their heritage. Why will they respect yours? You only believe that anything else will be the case because you are totally unfamiliar with Arab culture, Arab language, Arab ideology,
right.
And so stuff like that. And then the final step is exhibit, you know, and I usually use the white genocide documentary that's made by Oris the Avenger, but sometimes I use, With Open Gates too is a great video, you know, and it's just by the end of it, like they have to pick a side, you know, you're forcing right. them on the spot to pick, you know, these beautiful bits of European civilization that you've confronted them with, or the utter destruction that they've just seen, you know, that's coming for them. And usually they pick the good side.
Yeah. That sounds very compelling.
Yeah. Yeah. My best record so far is I converted a Bernie Sanders supporter into a race warrior in 9 tweets.
Lord, okay. Well, I'm taking notes here, and again, to Google, I sing a song of race war.
Yeah. So I was inspired because like I'm a data driven person, right? Like that's my like I worked in financial services, I worked in advertising, and I believe in quantitative methods, right? So whatever we do has to win the A/B test, and you should be able to measure your success.
A/B test.
Yeah, like A/B testing, multivariate testing. These are basically when you pit different copy and ads, right? You pit them against each other.
Right. Okay.
And then you ask which of the campaigns win. And advertising went through sort of a renaissance because of this idea. Like it used to be like the madman thing where there would be a guy making like a big campaign pitch, right? And he would be selling not really to the audience, but to the people that were buying the advertising. And eventually people came up with the idea, no, we should make advertising into a science, right? And we should we should sort of measure the results, and it shouldn't be just our speculation on what's correct and what sells things. It should be actual things that we can measure and reproduce. And when this happened, advertising became drastically orders of magnitude more effective. You know, mm-hmm. there was a lot of resistance to the idea at the beginning because, you know, the ad people were like, I'm really not selling ads. They knew that they weren't really selling ads to an audience. They were selling ads to people, and they thought that, you know, this would result in the destruction of their industry. But eventually, like, it became way more ad dollars got spent because ads were so much more effective. So it worked out for them. But I think it's a lot of things that have been going on have sort of not been, you know, nobody in political communities other than really established people actually have this attitude towards selling their ideas. They, you know, it's everybody in the far right or centrist authoritarians for a long time has just been, in the speculative mode of, I'm going to say this or I'm going to do this. And I think that adopting quantitative methods is like the most important hurdle to take in advancing whatever your idea in the world is. This is the sort of thing I do. I try to act at scale or I try to give other people tools, but I try to make them, measurably effective.
That's really interesting. There's a kind of convergence going on in the force here because, just in the last few days, I've had conversations with several people who actually know how to do number crunching type stuff and know how to, administer surveys, and we've been talking about the necessity of surveying the people who come to our websites and really trying to get inside their heads so that we can come up with more effective forms of outreach. So that's a project we're working on. Several people are working on that at the same time, and we're all converging together. So stay tuned.
Ad industry term for that is called choice modeling. There's a bunch of great literature on it. So, if you want to follow up on that.
Yeah. I mean, as Mike Enix said, that people who sell dildos have a better idea of what's going on inside the heads of their audience than we who are trying to save the white race and save the world. You know? So we need to up our game. We need to get serious here.
No doubt about it. No doubt about it. I've sort of, you know, I think that there's been very little connection, and I think it's sort of definitely coming together now is that previously, like, the people in sort of my camp, you know, I've been at this a while since like 2008, but like the meme far right has, before the Trump campaign especially, I think has been sort of a separate entity from the far right that's sort of the traditional and academic crowd. You know, I think that, I ran a web board called SAS for a while, and it was the precursor to my posting career. My posting career is around now because I shut down SAS because I just didn't care about it anymore. Mm-hmm. And they held that against me forever. You know, I recorded a video apology for them when I went to prison. but there was all these people that were thinking and acting, you know, that were just, it was like, the meme internet, you know, has been sort of on our sort of political scale for a long time. Mm-hmm. But it's just now sort of connecting with the people that like you.
Yeah.
That have been doing this sort of like in an intellectual manner.
Yeah, I mean, webzine type publishing and journal type publishing is what I've been doing, and book publishing. And yeah, one of the things that really I think has sort of been an interface between that world and my world has been the Daily Shoah, and also just meeting a lot of people in the New York metro area who are involved in NRX blogging and other areas. But I also met people who just craft memes and videos, and it's just an amazing area of creativity. And I remember, really, it was around 2010 when we started Countercurrents, and I created a Facebook page, and I had certain people as Facebook friends who were coming up with these memes all the time, and I just thought, you know, the standard two-panel meme is one of the most effective ways at illustrating double standards, screwed up priorities, just all the perversions in our political process. And I really have to take my hat off to the people who can just encapsulate a big message in a small space with a couple of images. I think it's really great propaganda. Since then, it's evolved tremendously.
Yeah.
It's remarkable the number of people who are contributing to it and the sophistication of it and the sort of private language languages that have sort of emerged around it. And then the potential for high comedy as people sort of riff off these different memes, it's really a remarkable field of culture propaganda. I think we're now in the position where we are driving political debate. The Cuckservative thing was driving political debate last year. I thought that was remarkable. That's a huge change.
Yeah, it was gigantic. I mean, it's really been amazing, like how much progress has been made in so little time. I mean, I know that TRS and Daily Storm are basically like they've hit sort of an exponential growth spot. Like it is a very bright future for this sort of political niche, I think.
I would agree. I think more people than ever before are coming into this. Another thing that I really loved was last fall I was traveling in Europe and I was meeting these young guys from the Baltic states, and it was like, okay, they know everything about their own history, as you would expect, but they were also totally immersed in an international culture that included stuff like The Daily Show, 4chan, Pole, anime, and memes, and I just thought, this is hilarious. We have a common language that we can speak now, and it's all over the racially aware right, especially the youth wing, which is where all the growth is taking place.
Yeah. I mean, it's, I think that there's so much more. Millennials are just, they realize they're looking downward, that they're the generation on the cusp of just everything going to shit. And it's, there's been so much prosperity from previous generations but eventually it just, the policies made it run out and millennials have just been handed this pile of shit. And they're mad, some of them will be enticed by the media and voting socialist, but it's not really going to help them out any. And eventually they're going to have to come over to our camp. Like all the men in huge numbers are coming our way, I think. But, it's going to take a little bit more to convince the women.
Yeah. I think so. But I think women, just psychologically speaking, sort of follow behind men anyway. And so.
Yeah.
I don't worry so much about that. I think that once we have a lot of men involved in something and it's actually making headway, that women are going to see that this really is in their interest as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So what can Countercurrents do better, in your opinion?
I'd say first you want to look at like these quantitatively measurable things, right? Like you want to start thinking, how can I set goals that are quantitative and meet them? You can do this in a number of ways. You could purchase very small advertising campaigns. Like Twitter has great targeting and analytics, they're expensive as hell, right? But I'm saying like, do very, very small campaigns on unsuspecting people that is like, mm-hmm. people not in our community and try to get things on various ad platforms that are really subtle, and will evade censors, but that you can measure, like, what does this, what does this rhetoric, what effect does this line have? And you can spend like 25 cents on something and get a random audience that's never been exposed to you before.
Right.
And that's a really great thing. What else is good? I of course used Twitter ads too to make a big shit storm last year. I don't think that you could go so, I couldn't go so hard as I did on them. I made a promoted campaign for the 14 words and also for something about you know, whites need to defend themselves from violence and discrimination. And then I targeted basically towards feminist women and minorities and watched them all flip out. Mm-hmm. And I think the biggest converter to our cause is shitlib reactions. Like, triggering is the national sport now. People want to see the blue-haired establishment just break down and cry. Like, it's right. like when I did the printer flyers, like, I saw tweets from like total cucked, like, libertarian types, right? Like,
yeah.
And they were, they couldn't stop themselves from thinking it was hilarious, you know, because yeah. Everybody enjoys seeing the overbearing, you know, unreasonable establishment break down into tears. Like, it's
exactly.
And if you can find ways to confront people with ideas that make them sob, you know, that's always a really good thing. I think it's just, you can't argue with the data, and the data says that, that making cucks cry is the most effective thing that we've ever done in our lives.
And it just so happens to be really fun too.
Yeah, yeah, that's the best part. I mean, I was doing this stuff for fun, but turns out it's really, really effective.
Virtue and pleasure in perfect harmony.
I think that you want to think of what you do as a pyramid, like as some sort of sales enterprise, right? You want to figure out methods that are good and solid and repeatable, mm-hmm. and then teach other people in your group to use those methods, mm-hmm. so that you need growth that's beyond one layer, basically, right? Mm-hmm. It can't be you speaking to the whole world. You just can't be everywhere at one place at one time, but you can train people to use methods that have a proven success rate and distribute those methods, and suddenly, you know, you have a bunch of people that are working to advance your cause.
Mm-hmm. One thing I have been trying to do is just teach people to set up little cottage industries of publishing our material, especially people doing translations of my stuff and other Countercurrents books into European languages. I'm trying to teach them how to publish these things themselves and, you know, make a little money from it. So that's a kind of replicatable cottage industry. My basic attitude is that, you know, as long as I'm taking care of my own basic needs, I'm not really concerned with monopolizing all possible income from the stuff that I create. I'd like to have as many people as possible who are fully or partially independent financially, because they've found ways of monetizing spreading our propaganda.
Yeah, that'd be great. like money is definitely a limited factor here. I mean, I know that pretty much nobody can run good ads at this point that has super effective stuff. You know, it's pretty sad, but I think my posting career is the most flagrant that you can go without compromising your ads. They managed to keep theirs, and
that's interesting.
Yeah.
You mentioned Andreas Scholl years and years ago when I first got started writing for movement sites. I wrote a review of his Wayfaring Stranger CD for the Vanguard News Network of all places.
Awesome. Yeah. That's a great one. I'm really psyched about his role in Rodelinda. That's pretty much, he turned that into my favorite opera pretty fast. he's amazing. And I think technically, you know, it's sort of got a contrast in the way that sort of Cecilia Bartoli and Renee Fleming do. I think technically I like Philippe Jaroussky as a countertenor, except like he, you know, it's the stage passion of Andreas Scholl is just unparalleled. It's fantastic.
Yeah. So you're a classical music person. So am I. I really, I love that. That's one of my big things. you know, and wherever I live in the world, I'd like to be able to have certain access to live classical music. So my favorite place right now, as far as where I've spent any amount of time is Budapest, because it's just it's a beautiful place. And they have such an amazing music scene there, and it's so inexpensive. You know, you go to the Liszt Conservatory of Music, and you sit in one of the most, I think, the most beautiful and the most acoustically perfect concert hall I've ever been in. And, you know, see these fabulous concerts, and, you know, the tickets are like 1,000 forints, which sounds like a lot of money until you do the math, and it's like $3.60. And it's like, good God, you know?
Yeah. I had orchestral row seats to Tchaikovsky for like €8, I think, in Serbia. I was pretty psyched. It was a far cry from when I was living in New York and I had to save for 3 months to see one opera. It was, quite a contrast.
Yeah. You can get boxed seats at the Hungarian State Opera for what you pay for, nosebleed seats at the Metropolitan Opera in New York. And, you know, I got the catalog from the Hungarian State Opera for the current season, and I counted 72 different productions that they're doing.
Wow.
And, In New York, they're doing 24, so exactly one-third the amount that the Hungarians are doing. And, of course, Hungary has fewer than 10 million people in the entire country. And but the thing that really struck me is in the United States, they have opera matinees for really old people, you know, who can't stay awake at night anymore. And, you know, they're there with their walkers and wheelchairs. And, you know, someday I expect to see gurneys and IV drips and things like that, you know, showing up. And in Hungary, they have opera matinees for children.
That's great.
Yeah, it's just a totally different world. Well, anyway, we're getting close to an hour, so we should wrap this up. But I've really enjoyed just getting acquainted. So maybe last question should be, what do you think this movement should be doing? I mean, I think we're at a turning point. I think 2016 is going to be a turning point in history. What do we need to do to be ready?
I think the most important thing is to garner adeptness at technology. I think that software and hardware engineering are the two most important skills for the coming conflict, because warfare is about to be changed in a way that is drastic and currently favors European people, and that we are responsible for most innovations in software. Of course, I suppose in language theory you could give PHP to the Jews. That's Israeli, which is just largely regarded as an abomination. And I suppose you could give Ruby to the Japanese, which is also a pile of fucking garbage. But pretty much everything else is a white European invention. So warfare is about to become totally automated, and it's about to favor small actors, and that like additive manufacturing technologies are going to enable you to produce things very, very cheaply. And it's going to be about very small devices that are very cheap to produce in large numbers. And the most important thing that people can do to assure the survival of European civilization is become really good with technology as fast as you can, teach it to your children, and be prepared to engage in the kind of combat that is algorithmic.
Have you read John Robb's Global Guerrillas or his Brave New War book?
I've read Global Guerrillas, yeah. He's excellent.
I think he's really remarkable. I think that he's on our side, basically, too.
I think he's cagey
about things politically, but I think he's basically on our side.
Yeah, he's definitely red-pilled to some degree. I don't think you can study like Middle Eastern insurgency for too long without getting some very like explicit knowledge of race, right?
Yeah. And also, whenever he talks about the financial crisis, he always talks about parasite tribes, and it's like, what tribe would that be?
I wonder.
You know, the gypsies are a parasite tribe, but they're not well represented in the banking industry, you know?
No doubt.
But, I think he's a remarkable guy. I saw him actually speak in San Francisco, I think, in 2011, maybe 2012, and he signed my copy of Brave New War, which was exciting. I think that he has a lot of important stuff to say. basically, about exactly how conflict is going to play out in the future.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, Weave, thank you very much. This has been, I hope, the first of many conversations, and it's been great to make contact.
Absolutely, man. You have a good one.
All right, you too. Take care.